This is Richard Barone, and I'm doing an oral history interview with Mr. John Ballweg. Today is May 19th, 2003. It's approximately 1:03 p.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Special Collections Library interview room. And Mr. Ballweg, you are in Belcamp, Maryland. Sir, why don't we start with some biographical information on yourself. Could you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
Okay, I was born January 1st, 1941, in Baltimore, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Up until 10 years of age, it was pretty normal. Then my father died.
Mm-hmm.
I was only 10.
Okay.
And we had a rough time until, until I got out of high school, and then things started to come together.
Mm-hmm.
When I say about rough time, it wasn't anything as illegal or anything like that. It was just kind of financially rough for my mother.
Right, right. I can imagine. What did your father do for a living before
he was a supervisor for the Pepsi-Cola bottling company here.
Okay.
And I do have to say that if it weren't for the owners of the franchise here in Baltimore, I would not have had a private school education.
Hmm.
Even after my father died, they paid the tuition for me to go to a private high school.
Wow, that's wonderful. So did your mother work?
Yeah, she did, and then she married my stepfather, who was not the greatest person in the world.
Okay.
He wouldn't work, so after high school, I pretty much supported the family.
Really?
Until I finally made him get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And then from then, I was 23 when I went in the service.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had a student deferment, and I thought, no, I think I'll just go on in the service. So I went into the Intelligence Corps,
mm-hmm.
Fort Holabird, Maryland, where I was trained. While there, I applied for flight school.
Mm-hmm.
And in February of 65, I started my flight training.
Okay. Before we go there, let me ask you a couple questions about backing up a little bit into Baltimore. Tell me what kind of student you were, what your favorite subjects were in school.
I'd say more on the English history side. Math I was not very good at. I just couldn't grasp it. I tried a couple of years, so I ended up with like a general diploma.
Mm-hmm.
And but English history, back then it used to be geography.
Right.
Those were my favorites.
Did you play sports?
I was on a swimming team.
Okay.
Great. And we played intramural sports, football, baseball.
Mm-hmm. Was anybody in your family in the service, going back, you know, uncles?
My brother was.
Really?
He was drafted in 1956, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
Spent time in France. He was in the quartermaster.
Was he in the Army?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Was he any kind of influence on you as far as you joining the service?
No. No. None at all.
Okay.
I wanted to make something of myself, and I figured the service would be the way to do it.
And what year did you graduate high school?
58.
Okay. And did you go to college, or did you just
start
working?
I went to 2 years of college.
Mm-hmm.
And worked at the same time.
Okay. What did you do?
I worked for Pepsi for a while, and then I went with a company called Alco Gravure.
Mm-hmm.
Was a printing company, and worked for them until I went into the service.
Okay, and
also worked part time at a funeral home.
Okay, you said you basically supported the family after.
Yeah, I did. He thought he was a super salesman, and he couldn't sell a snowball to an Eskimo. So there was no money coming in, so I had to take just about everything I made to keep at least my mother and my sister together, you know, going.
Yes, sir. How many siblings did you have?
I got a brother and a half-sister.
Okay. And you were in the middle?
I'm in the middle.
Okay. So you graduated in 1958. You went to work. Which college did you go to for 2 years?
Anne Arundel Community College. Here in the Maryland area.
Okay. All right. What prompted you to stop working and go into the service?
Well, it was when I got my student deferment.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it and I thought to myself, you know, I'm not going anywhere with what I'm working at. I worked in an office that just drove me up the wall because I was not an inside person.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, let me give the service a try. And that's when I enlisted.
Okay, what year was this?
1964, January 22nd.
Okay. In 1964, how aware were you of U.S. foreign policy, what the United States was doing in Southeast Asia? This was, what you said, September, so it was right after the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Were you aware of what the United States was trying to do in Vietnam at this
point?
Well,
in 64, it was very little. I mean,
right.
It was strictly advisory at that time. And we, you know, it wasn't a lot said about it, and there wasn't a lot, you know, written about it, just that we were over there.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing like, you know, later on down the road.
Right.
And I just didn't... I really didn't think much of the foreign policy. I thought, well, I'll get a chance to do some traveling, and like I said, advance myself, and that's main reason. You know, there was a big sales pitch at the time from the services,
mm-hmm,
to enlist versus being drafted, because when you're enlisted, you're guaranteed where you're going to go or what you're
right.
going to do.
Right.
Drafted, you know, you could have done anything, and so that was really what prompted me. It wasn't anything like I said, patriotic or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to learn more.
What did you want to do? You said when you enlisted, you could kind of pick your direction. What did you choose?
Well, I chose the intelligence corps.
Mm-hmm.
That was the intelligence headquarters at that time was at Fort Holabird, Maryland, in Baltimore,
mm-hmm,
and. I sort of goofed up when I filled out the paperwork because I wanted to be an agent, and I ended up putting analyst down. Again, I was stuck behind a desk, you know.
Right.
So I did go to basic training, Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Tell me about that. What was your basic training like?
At that time, when I look, of course, I look back now, it was nothing, but then, at that time, looking at it through my eyes, it was pure hell, you know.
Yes, sir.
I started out, I thought, oh my God, what did I get myself into? And, I mean, it was, you know, screaming in your face and all this. Now, oh, jeez. And, well, I got sick. I was, had pneumonia for a week, and I was recycled.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, they just harassed the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was getting ready to go into the hospital, I mean, the company commander and all that, and I thought, like I said, I thought, oh, geez, is there a way to get out of this? I thought, no, I've signed on the dotted line, and I raised my hand, so I'm stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So came out, and I tell you, some of the worst things were the runs. I mean, we were running 2 and 3 miles a morning.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, you ran in full combat gear. You didn't run in tennis shoes and jogging suits the way they do today.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I mean, that would start out at like 4:30 in the morning, and we'd finish up like 10:30 at night.
Mm-hmm.
So there were long days, and of course, you didn't have a lot of time to think because, you know, they kept you moving.
Mm-hmm.
And I sure peeled my share of potatoes. As they still had KP then. I understand now they have contractors.
Mm-hmm.
But
how long did the basic last?
It was 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. It was 8 weeks. Actually, for me, it was 10 because of losing the first week that before I got sick, and then the week I was in the hospital. So actually, mine took 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was transferred to Fort Holabird for advanced individual training.
What? Tell me about your platoon leaders or your drill sergeants there at Fort Jackson. Had they been either in Korea or anywhere else, and did they relate any of these experiences to you?
Well, the first week, like I said, the company commander, he was fresh out of college, ROTC, so he hadn't been anywhere, he's second lieutenant. The second time, when I was recycled, I was in a company with a captain, and he had been overseas. Mm-hmm. He never said a lot about it. My drill sergeant, my platoon sergeant, he was American Indian, mm-hmm. and he was a hard-nosed. I mean, he had seen it all, and he would relate, you know, that you think this is easy, you wait till you get out there in the real life, and, you know, mm-hmm. things like that. As far as any personal experiences, no, they didn't get close to you. They wouldn't open up like that. I mean, they were there to do the job, and it was, you know, it's almost like being, I'm sure you've heard the term TAC officer.
Yes, sir.
You know, and then they are strictly there to get in your face and to get you through a course, and they didn't care whether you liked them, whether you were not like them. You know, it wasn't, they didn't care less because, you know, in 8 weeks you were gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, and he put me through some stuff because of being recycled. He hadn't gotten me off the bus and all that. I mean, I'd come in from the hospital. And, you know, there were things like shining his boots and things like that. That, mm-hmm. of course, nowadays, you know, it's verboten. But back then, it was accepted.
What was the most difficult aspect of your basic training?
I'd say the physical training. Mm-hmm. It was. It was very, very intense.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any problem on the ranges. I didn't have any problem in the classrooms. But the physical side, like, you know, every morning getting up and running like a, you know, that was the hardest.
Right. What kind of weapons training did you have?
Well, I had M14s. Mm-hmm. And that's all we were trained in basic was M14s. I didn't get into anything else until I got into flight school.
How were you on the M14? Was it?
I was a sharpshooter. I made sharpshooter.
Okay.
I didn't make expert, but and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that part of it.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about going to Fort Hollibird. You knew you were going because you had signed up for intelligence school.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right. Okay. Yes.
What was that like in Baltimore? Was it much different from Fort Jackson?
Oh, quite a bit. It was more of a campus. Mm-hmm. You know, the type of courses we were taking were all classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And we still had PT, but it was nothing like it was in basic. I was fortunate that I could live at home.
Okay.
Because I was within commuting distance. And for a private, that was, you know, really unheard of. But since I lived so close, and they were crammed. They were, you know, crammed for space.
Mm-hmm.
But I still, it was... Not much, you know, I mean, even though I lived at home, I still had to be there for Reveille,
right.
Which was 5:30, which meant I had to get up like 3:30 in the morning instead of 5, you know, because
mm-hmm.
I had to drive up.
Mm-hmm.
But I had my share of KP there, too. But as far as, you know, comparing it to basic, there was no comparison.
So you said it was mainly classroom, a lot of classroom
yes,
training.
Yes, it was. Because analysts, you know, we had to analyze all the intelligence information coming in and make sure it was channeled in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Photo analysis and things like that. So like I said, it was mostly classroom.
So they would teach you how to analyze a photograph, how to analyze a report that would come across your desk?
Correct.
Okay. Do you remember anything that they told you?
Oh, Lord. I mean, I'm looking back in 1964.
Right.
So,
at the time, did it make sense to you? Did it seem like, okay, yeah, I can do this, or was it difficult for you?
No, it was quite easy. I mean, it was easy to pick up, and that's when, of course, being in the intelligence corps, James Bond was the big deal then, back in the, that's when he first came out.
Yes, sir.
And the bookstores were full of his books.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, all of us students were reading James Bond. It was very easy to do that type of work. And like I said, I thought to myself after that, I thought, man, you know, I wanted to get out there in civilian clothes and play the agent bit, you know.
Right.
And I really goofed up by checking the wrong block.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still good. It was still enjoyable. And I was there from April. I finished my course, and I had orders to go to Frankfurt, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, I had applied for flight school.
Now, why did you do that?
I thought I'd learn to fly. I had tried flying when I was a teenager,
mm-hmm.
And I got the crap scared out of me by an instructor, and I was, no, that's not for me. But then it came out that they were looking for candidates for flight school, and I applied. I took all the tests, and I passed them, and took my orientation ride, and I loved it. It was on a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And so once the paperwork went through the CO's desk, passed the CO's desk, I was frozen.
Mm-hmm.
They could not ship me out.
Okay.
So I wasn't even accepted yet, but the process had started. So they put me in what they call a casual company, and I was working for this old E8 who ran the interrogation.
This is still at Holabird?
Still at Holabird.
Okay.
And I played the prisoner of war.
Okay.
For the different, classes that would come through.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd get the day before, I'd get a roll sheet, I'd have to, this is what you're supposed to be, you're supposed to be meek and mild, and, you're supposed to be a very aggressive and, scream at the interrogators and all that, depending on, what role I was playing.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that until I was accepted into flight school, which was like November of 64. And I was going to go, I was to report in February at Fort Walters, Texas. Well, in January, my mother went in the hospital for exploratory surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there. I mean, like I said, I worked for this old E8, and he was a great, great guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he gave me the time off to go to the hospital while she was having a surgery.
Right.
And I was the only one there, and the doctor came out and told me that it was cancer,
mm.
and that it was pancreatic, and that there was nothing he could do.
Mm.
Well, I thought for a few days, and I went to this E8, and I said, I'm going to withdraw my application. I want to stay close to my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was sort of a mama's boy. I mean, I'd helped her through all this stuff with my stepfather.
Yes, sir.
And so he sat me down and talked to me like a father,
mm-hmm.
that I hadn't had in years. And he said, does your mother know how sick she is? I said, no. He said, what do you think she would think if you all of a sudden decide to stay here? Yes, you can. We can get you a compassionate assignment here. But what do you think she'd think? I said, well, she'd probably realize something's really serious. He said, you're right. Now, what did your brother do with his life? I said, well, he quit school when he was drafted and all this. And he said, now look at you. You are going to flight school. You're going to become an officer. Now, what does your mother feel about that? I said, she's very proud of the fact that, one of her sons has really gone somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Ron, and that's the first time he ever called me Ron. It was always Ballwig. Hey, Ballwig this, hey, Ballwig that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Ron, it'd be a big mistake if you stayed because your mother would know what was going on. And also, she would always feel like it was her fault that you did not succeed.
Hmm.
So I thought, okay. All right. And he said, now, if anything happens, they'll send you home, over the weekends or anything else that you need. Don't worry about that.
Mm-hmm.
So then I just said, okay. So I went to flight school.
It made sense to you.
Yeah, it did. It did. It really did. And I kept, the letters really going to my mother, and I knew that things were getting bad with her. But so at the time, I was not dating anybody. Well, one of the student nurses where my mother had been in the hospital, I was writing to her, but as far as anything serious, I wasn't, because I was engaged before I was accepted to flight school, and my fiance broke it off with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been going together for 3 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went to flight school.
When was this, when you went down to Fort Walters?
February 65.
Okay.
And so I was out for, and again, that was like a college campus down there. The colonel, the post commander, had said, put out a directive that, look, these young men are training to fly. They're training to do something that is not a natural thing with them, especially with helicopters. So we don't need to harass them on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a college campus.
Mm-hmm. How long was your training to last?
Well, that lasted until the end of May.
Okay.
So it was split at that time between two posts there in Fort Rucker, Alabama.
Okay.
So I was at it. We did stand retreat, and I was at a retreat one evening. And they called me in. I had a phone call, and it was my ex-fiance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got back together, and my mother was upset about it because she said, you know, all she wants to do is get out of the house. You know, she's a real nice girl, but you know, I young and in love, you don't think of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So between when we left Fort Walters, we left on a Friday, and we had to report in on Monday. But that sergeant was true to his word about them letting me have time because they knew, you know, the school knew the condition of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And they let me go home en route.
Okay.
So I could fly back here to Baltimore as long as I was down there at Fort Rucker on Monday morning.
Okay.
And so I did, and then my fiance and I saw each other too, and my mother calmed down a little bit about that, and everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
She was really swollen, you know, and I didn't think anything of it because
mm-hmm.
everything's, you know, again, being young, I didn't think, you know, everybody's going to live forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Fort Rucker, and then it was like, that was like candidate school.
Okay.
I mean, they had not gone to the college campus.
Okay.
And, but it was fun. It was fun in a way. It wasn't physical. It was just the seniors would get in your face and, you know, you were like a plebe.
Mm-hmm.
So,
this was your flight training?
At flight training, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you describe to me exactly how they trained you and what you learned?
Well, in Fort Walters, I had trained on the H-23 helicopter, which was made by Hiller out of Hagerstown, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
Just a small three-passenger bubble. It was one of the old bubbles.
Now, you had never flown before, had you?
I had never flown before.
How was it the first time you actually flew the helicopter?
Petrifying. you're moving everything. You're moving. Of course, you've got to keep your head on a swivel to make sure you're not going to run into anything.
Mm-hmm.
Your right hand is working a control, your left hand is working another control, and both feet are working pedals.
Right.
And it's like, you know, if you talk about being coordinated, if you're not coordinated, forget it. You know, and I was not coordinated.
Did you have doubts that you were going to make it through this?
Oh, there for the first 10 hours, I thought, I'll never make this.
Mm-hmm.
I finally got the aircraft under control, but then we'd be flying along, and the instructor pilot would cut the power like, we had an engine failure,
right?
And I turned into the trees instead of into an open field. You know, just I wasn't looking, is what I was. I wasn't thinking ahead,
right?
So he said, "I'm going to put you up for what they call a prog ride, which was a progress check with the flight commander. And you know, if you bust it, then you're out." So I went up, and I did everything right. 3 hours later, I soloed. So, and from then on, it was a piece of cake. I mean, I look at a helicopter today, nothing to fly in them. But back then, forget it.
Well, it seems like that was a psychological hurdle you just overcame that one.
Right. Well, they are not made to fly. An airplane is built aerodynamically.
Right.
A helicopter is not. It's like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
And you're forcing it to fly. So
that's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah. you forced that airplane, that aircraft into the air.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got into Fort Rucker, I went into the old H-19s, which they would give us a row, like Charlie row.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Find one that flies. That's what they were so old.
Well,
find one that you, you know that you can fly, because you always went out and found something wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
So you sometimes you go through four before you got a decent one.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. We would taxi on out to the takeoff pad, and we would lift it up to a hover, and we would do a, what they call a clearing turn, which means you push in the left pedal and turn the aircraft 90 degrees to make sure there's no aircraft flying over you as you, you know, come back around to turn to take off. But in reality, what we were doing was a power check.
Mm-hmm.
And with left pedal in a helicopter, that takes power. It's just the opposite of an airplane. With right, with when you put in right pedal,
mm-hmm.
when it takes more power for right pedal with an airplane. With a helicopter, it's left pedal. And if it doesn't stay at a hover, then you go back and you find another one. That was the reality. It was what that check was.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew those for, oh, like 60 hours
mm-hmm.
Over a period of 3 months.
Were you gaining more and more confidence
yeah.
as you went along?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How much classroom training did you have to complement what you
It was half and half. You fly in the morning. And then you would go to class for 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon.
Do you ever have any accidents?
No, not a one.
Anybody in your class have any accidents?
Yes, we had one. There was this, the guy went up for his solo. We used to solo in auto rotations, which meant you come down without power.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on his second time around. His first auto rotation wasn't too bad. His second time around... he came in, and they hollered on the radio because I was in another aircraft. He said, "Candidate Armstrong, cut it, shut it down." "Why? Why?" "I just hit a little hard." He said, "Look around behind you. You don't have a tail boom left." Took the tail
wow.
boom off. Yeah.
Wow.
So, but he still graduated.
Hmm.
I mean, that you know that was part of training, and
mm-hmm.
So then we got into some you know. Tactical flying blackout flying, totally black, no lights on aircraft, no except for your dash lights,
mm-hmm.
Cockpit lights, no lights on the ground except for land to a flashlight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little hairy, but it was fun. It got to be fun then.
Okay.
Then after I got through that, then I went into the Hueys, the UH-1s,
mm-hmm.
and we did instruments in that.
How did
and
you?
That was another whole ball game.
Okay.
You know,
what do you mean by that?
Well, you finally get to fly this thing, and I feel really good. And then when they put the hood on you, oh, my God, you know, you're everywhere in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and because all you're doing is flying off the instrument.
You're talking about when they put the hood on you, meaning you have a cover and you can't see around you.
They put a hood on your helmet, and you're looking straight at the instrument panel, and that's it.
Oh, okay, okay.
And they put a black cover over the chin bubble so you can't see out.
Wow.
So, of course, the instructor, he's sitting there. He's looking around. You know, he's clear. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he's VFR. But I got through that, and I was the second one to finish my flight training out of the class.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed getting my instrument ticket back then by an argument.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you explain?
Well, the check pilot had us in the holding, what they call a holding pattern before you landed. They let other ones land ahead of you.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, all right, extend your outbound leg, and then as you turn inbound, you will be cleared for approach. Well, once I passed the 1 minute, because it was a 1 minute holding pattern, I said, I'm leaving holding pattern, descending.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he said, no, no. He said, you're not. You didn't, you know, he passed me. But he didn't give me my instrument ticket. He said, because you didn't leave your holding pattern. You were still on the racetrack. I said, yeah, but I was past the 1 minute. So it was an argument.
Okay.
You know, it was technicality.
Okay.
So then we graduated. Well, let me back up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the process, my mother died.
Okay. While you were at Fort Rucker.
While I was at Fort Rucker, yeah. She, it was in September. And I got a phone call from my fiance. Mm-hmm. Nobody else had called me. My stepfather wasn't going to bother me until later. Mm-hmm. Well, she called me and told me what had happened, and I said, all right, well, the Red Cross got me home. And so after the funeral, of course, I had to go back. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'm going to be recycled because I missed the escape and evasion night. It was where they put you out at night and you have to get through the enemy lines and all that. Mm-hmm. And TAC officer called me in and he said, we're gonna waive that for you. We're gonna keep you with your class. So I didn't have to go through that. I went through survival and all that, but mm-hmm. not the escape and evasion. It was only a one night thing.
Right.
So then I graduated from flight school.
When was that?
November 23rd, 1965.
Okay. Now, at this point, were you coached or were you told that you're probably going to end up in Vietnam? Were you guys aware of this?
Well, at the time, again, it wasn't really the big push for Vietnam because
right.
most of my class went to Korea.
Okay.
I had put in for a compassionate assignment to Fort Meade when my mother was still alive because that's how far in advance you had to put in for things.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it. I was assigned to the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, Fort Meade, Maryland.
Okay.
None of my class went directly to Vietnam.
Okay.
Because, as I said, that was in 65 before any of the build-up. I mean, it was still advisory.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of them did go to Korea. Some went to Germany. And November 23rd, I graduated. And the 20th of the morning, right after graduation, of course, we were released, and I had bought a car down there. So my stepfather and my half-sister came down for the graduation,
mm-hmm.
and she pinned my wings on me since my mother wasn't there.
Right.
So then we drove on home overnight. We got home on Friday mm-hmm. back here to Maryland,
mm-hmm.
and I was married Saturday.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was, we had it all set up. And so then I was stationed at, like I said, at Fort Meade. And in, March mm-hmm. or April of 66, we got the word that we were being built up to go to Vietnam.
Okay.
Because we were at a skeleton force there. So,
what were your duties at Fort
Meade? I was a property book officer for the Air Cav Troop at okay. 11, at Fort Meade. Didn't realize how many thousands of dollars I was signing for as a W-1, but I signed for it. We found it all. And it was a good life there with the Cav.
Mm-hmm.
We flew some very antiquated aircraft. That we flew Bell H-13s, had the old wooden blades on them. They were built back in the 50s.
Wow.
Because everything was being built to be shipped overseas.
Mm-hmm.
When I found out that we were being built up, all of a sudden, all my classmates started showing up from Korea. They were cut short in Korea and sent to us.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of my classmates were right with me at Fort Meade until we went over in July of 66.
Mm-hmm.
We loaded the ships in July, and then I went over in August as an advance party because it took that long for the ships to get over that I didn't have to go. So I was there a month before the ships even got there.
Okay. How did you get over?
I flew over a C-141.
Okay.
Out of PWI. It was Friendship Airport at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Troop seats all the way,
wow.
20-some hours.
Wow.
Not a comfortable ride. We went to Alaska, and from Alaska we went to Japan, and then from Japan on into Saigon.
Now, tell me your thoughts at this point of, going into a war zone. How did you feel about that?
Well, I was very adamant. I said I could never shoot another human being.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I was apprehensive like everybody else was, because we were told, you know, that we were told that they knew we were coming.
Okay.
Meaning
the enemy knew.
Yes, we were told that the Viet Cong had sent our regimental commander a letter saying, we know you're coming and we're waiting for you.
Okay.
Again, I was apprehensive. I would have been assigned to headquarters, regimental headquarters in the aviation section.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in supply there, tech supply.
Okay.
For aircraft supply. But I was still a mission pilot. I could, you know, that wasn't 100%. That was an additional duty.
Mm-hmm.
And, when we got over there and, you know, we got on the buses and there's, you know, wire, real small wire.
Right.
On the, windows of the bus.
Right.
And we said, hey, what's all this for? So a grenade won't come through, you know.
Wow.
We didn't know.
Right. This was in Saigon?
Yeah, yeah.
What were your first impressions of Vietnam when you landed in the country?
Hot.
Okay.
It was miserably hot. I mean, we stepped off the aircraft, and within 20 minutes, we were drenched from sweat.
Mm-hmm.
And so they loaded us on the buses right away and took us out to an area called Long Bin,
mm-hmm.
which was like a staging area for units coming into the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, there it is right there. And we looked, and it was nothing but just an open space, just mud.
Mm-hmm.
You know, got to put your tents up here. Lord. So, well, we got the tents up. Like I said, it was total mud. But then they took the pilots and they farmed us all out to different units for in-country training.
Okay.
Because they didn't want, you know, with a unit coming over, all the pilots were green as far as in-country.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to get some in-country training. So I was shipped to, Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
I flew with the Thunderbirds. There was 502nd Aviation Night. It's been so long. It's something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were strictly an airlift company.
Okay, and this was for your training?
Yes, for in-country training. So I flew with them for 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
Missions every day. And it was like the old Second World War movies that you'd see that mm-hmm. the pilots would go out, and you know, they'd do their job, and then at night they'd come back, and they'd all end up at the club.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's basically the way this was, because the unit lived in they had a name for it. I can't. It was inside of a compound,
mm-hmm.
but it was, private rooms, almost like a motel.
Okay.
And then they had their own club and mess hall.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I really stands out because I flew with this one guy quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the missions we did were strictly admin missions, you know, to go from town to town, and it was like a one-shift mission.
Right.
So this guy I was flying with, we went into this one place, I know, for 3 days in a row, and the third day was my last day,
mm-hmm.
and I found out just a couple days later that fourth day, he went in there and didn't come out. He got shot coming out.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, the Lord was with me. It's the only thing I can say.
Mm-hmm. So he did not survive?
He did not survive, no.
Where were you flying into?
It was just a small hamlet,
mm-hmm.
Where special forces were and the Arvin, you know, the Army of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
had an outpost. And we just go in there to like resupply or take mail, stuff like that. In.
Right, right. How did you do flying in country? Your first training, just these 2 weeks.
I did pretty good. I just like I said, I felt really comfortable because I had been out of flight school for about 9 months, and I had flown quite a few different type aircraft
mm-hmm.
Before I went over. Before we were even activated in February of 65, they. I was TDY'd of Bell Helicopter Company
mm-hmm.
In Fort Worth, and I ferried Hueys out to the coast to be shipped overseas. So I'd got a lot of cross country there.
Right.
But No, I didn't feel too bad. You know, I listened to them. I did what they told me. You know, you take off running, and then you just climb like a homesick angel, and you get to 3,000 feet because most small arms, you know, there's nothing that can touch you above 3,000 unless it's a 50 caliber.
Right.
So,
did you take any fire during these 2 weeks?
Yeah, we did take some when I was on some of the insertions.
Okay.
I went out on some insertions. Didn't get hit. No, the aircraft didn't get hit. We were taking fire, but
How did it feel for you to know that you were under fire?
You know, it didn't really bother me until afterwards.
Okay.
And you know, I think the adrenaline was pumping so hard
that
it was afterwards I'd start to shake. Not bad. You know, it's like one more day down. You know, that's where
we
started counting.
Right. You knew you had 365.
Yeah, and yeah. And we started a short timer's counter as soon as we got there. So
let me ask you a question, sir. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem.
What did you have any cultural training on the Vietnamese people and culture, and what did you know about why you're actually there?
Well, we were told, you know, we were over there to stop the domino effect.
Okay.
I'm sure you've heard that saying.
Yes, sir.
Domino effect was, you know, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand. You know, they were. Mm-hmm. They said the communists were just going to keep knocking them down. And we were there at the request of the South Vietnamese government to stop the North and the Viet. Well, at the time, it was just the Viet Cong from wreaking havoc in the country. And, again, we were guests. So that's what we were told. We were always told we were guests.
Okay.
We weren't there. We were there because... You know, the United States had signed a treaty with CETO. You know, we were part of that Southeast Asian Treaty Organization.
Did you feel like a guest?
At times, at times. I felt like somebody, all they want to do is take my money.
Right.
I very rarely did I ever go into town. I mean, there was nothing there for me anyway.
Right.
But at times, you know, and then... I really felt sorry for the kids.
The Vietnamese children?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they were just, they were ragtag, you know, and, my God, you know, we'd be somewhere and they'd come running up and, we all just gave, you know, if we had candy, we'd give them candy and stuff. I mean, they were just, and if you threw it, I mean, they were just like a pack of dogs, you know, going after it. So, and the, you know, I found that the Vietnamese women were very, very pretty when they were young. They aged extremely fast.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I really don't know. But they, you would see a girl at 18, 20 years old. I mean, she could be on a magazine cover. And 10 years later, she looked like she was 60. Why? I don't, whether it's a hard life, because it was a very hard life. I remember seeing their homes built out of beer cans.
Right.
They would flatten the beer cans, you know, open them up, and that would be the siding and the roof of their homes. Things like their culture was totally, totally foreign. I would you'd see them going down the road, and if they had to go relieve themselves, it was right there on the side of the road. And I told my wife, she said she still can't believe this, that they would use a rock to clean themselves with.
Right.
And she said, "You got to be kidding." I said, "I'm serious." So, you know, it could be some of that. It could be, you know, the hygiene was non-existent. The rivers over there, I never did see a clear river. They're all mud. And I'm sure it was all from sewage. It had to have been. Even with when we were in a dry season, it was still brown water. So I just, it could have been that. But as, they're, I don't know, they just, they, and they had been under, you know, they had been, war had been going on there for hundreds of years.
Yes, sir.
Always. So, this was nothing new to them. You know, it wasn't a where, oh, we're going to stop it all. They probably thought, they're here for a while, then they'll go, and it will be back to normal again.
How much contact did you actually have with the
Vietnamese? Very little, very little. Our regimental commander would not allow them on base.
Okay.
He was very, very strict about that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the units, you know, they would come in, they'd have the house girls take mm-hmm. care of them. No, not us. We didn't like it at the time, but probably it was a good idea. The only, I don't want to call them foreigners because we were the foreigners, but the only ones that were not American that were on post were Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran our PX.
What were your impression of the Koreans?
Oh, they were okay. There was a, of course, they had some combat people there too.
Mm-hmm.
They had the White Horse Division, which was really a crack division, and they were never beat.
Mm-hmm.
They were never beat. They again, a story. I don't know if it's true, but probably it is. Can you hold, Richard? I just got a beep.
Absolutely.
My wife is out there, and I don't know where she is.
Absolutely. I'll pause it.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
So this the White Horse Division, as I said, you know, they never lost a battle, but we had heard at one time that they did have a really rough time.
Mm-hmm.
And the division commander brought, this one company did, I'll put it that way. He brought the company commander and the first sergeant up in front of the whole division, and I heard they shot him.
Wow.
And that was, I mean, going all over, it wasn't just that I had heard it from one person. I mean, mm-hmm. we heard, you know, they just didn't take any stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We never had any operations with them. We didn't get into any combat with them, but,
mm-hmm.
They were pretty upstanding people. They didn't take any crap.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever work with any of the Australian or New Zealand troops?
No, I've talked to them on the radio because we would fly through their area. Their area was kangaroo control.
Mm-hmm.
We would when we were leaving our base camp to go down to Vung Tau to make a resupply run,
mm-hmm.
we would have to go through their area, and that'd be that the only time. As far as ran into them a couple times in the clubs, but you know they're pretty decent guys.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of the Arvin of the South Vietnamese forces?
Worthless.
Why do you say that?
Well, we would take them out in the morning on a search and destroy mission and mm-hmm. Drop them, and we'd pick them up at 5 o'clock that evening, and they'd all be they had dead chickens hanging over their shoulders.
Huh.
You know, it was a big game to them.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one time we had an insertion, and this guy wouldn't get out. Now, that scared us.
Mm-hmm.
He ran back and forth from side to side in that aircraft, and we had to take off because the whole unit, the whole formation was going.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled out my .45 and turned around, and the other guy was flying. And I said, next time in, because we had to go back and get another load.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and he didn't speak English, but I made sure that he knew that he was getting out the next time one way or the other.
Right. Did he?
Yep. Yep. Uh-huh. And all he did was, you know, we didn't know. He could have had a satchel on him.
Right.
We don't know.
Right.
And because, you know, during the day they were your friends, and at night they were the VC.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not a comfortable ride back to pick up the other ones.
Right. Well, let's go back. When you finished your two-week training in Benoit, did you go back to Long Bin?
I went back for a few days, and then they shipped me to a maintenance unit in Phu Loi.
Okay.
Because I was going to be in maintenance and tech supply.
How long were you there?
I was there for about 2 weeks.
Okay.
So the day I got there, the company commander was they were having a cookout because he was going home the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It made me feel great. Brand new, and he's going home.
Mm-hmm.
That was strictly, like I said, a maintenance, and that was an upper echelon maintenance. They would take the aircraft that were wrecked or crashed and rebuild them right there.
Mm-hmm.
And their call sign was Pipe Smoke.
Okay.
And we did a lot of recovery missions.
Going out and getting the wrecked
choppers? Yeah, getting the ones that were either shot down or crashed, yeah.
Would you fly out with the Chinooks?
The Chinook would come out and take them, but we'd go out there and get them rigged.
Okay.
You know, put the straps on them and everything, and the Chinook would come in. But Chinook would not land.
Right.
They'd come in, and we'd just hook the strap to it, and once we were clear, they'd just take off and go, and then we would follow them back.
Now, you've been in country, what, about a month and a half now at this point, or about a month?
About a month.
How did you feel? Did you feel more comfortable as the longer you were there, or were you still...
Yeah, I did. I felt a lot more comfortable. I felt, I hadn't really seen any hard action, so I was ready to get back to my unit, because, like I said, we were at Long Bend, but then once the whole unit got in and got, offloaded off the ships, then we were given our permanent base camp, which was Swan Lock. That's X-U-A-N-L-O-C. Again, that was just in the middle of a jungle, and we had to take the engineers in and do everything.
Okay. And was that your permanent base?
That was our permanent base, yeah.
Okay.
That was called Black Horse.
Okay.
And we had to go in and clear it all. We had to build a runway.
Mm-hmm.
We had to build the revetments for the aircraft to sit in. We had to, fix our tents up as much as we could.
Mm-hmm.
Tell
me about the base. What was it like? What were your quarters like? Your chow
hall? I lived in a tent for a year.
Okay.
The only thing I had was a plywood floor, screens on the side of the tent, but none of the stuff. They had a kit they called Wabtoc, and that was a wooden frame that you would put up, and then the tent would go over it.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't even have the wooden frame.
Wow. How many men to your tent?
There were four of us.
Okay.
I was with officers, we were four to a GP GP large, and so we each had a quarter of a tent.
Okay.
And had a wall locker, but of course we had our bar. Everybody's got the bar. Everybody had a bar over
inside
there.
Your tent.
Yeah, and it was for all the officers. We just happened to be the one to get the bar.
Okay.
And right outside the front of the tent was our washstand, where they'd come around every morning and fill the GI cans with water, and that was our washstand.
Okay.
Showers were just wooden stalls with old fuel tanks from the jets on top.
Mm-hmm.
That would they put the water in there in the morning, and believe it or not, by the evening the water was hot because of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And
how about your chow hall?
It was strictly for headquarters regiment. Each squadron had their own.
Mm-hmm.
It was okay. We had fairly decent food. The only thing I always stuck in my craw was reconstituted milk. We never had fresh milk.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I learned to drink coffee without sugar, because the sugar would turn rancid. It was so hot.
Wow.
And but as far as the meals, they were okay. Nothing to write home about. They weren't like going to Outback or something like that.
But, right.
I mean, they were passable.
Right. Now, the whole 11th cab was located at Swan Lock?
Yes.
Or? Okay.
Again, that was a base cab. Now, most of the time, one of the squadrons was gone, out on operations.
Right, right.
And each squadron had their own aviation section. They might have just a couple of aircraft in a section, but we also had an air cav troop.
Mm-hmm.
And that was... strictly gunships.
Okay.
So they were for aerial support for the squadron.
Mm-hmm. What other facilities did you have on base there that you could go to?
Well, we had a PX and we had an officers club. Again, they were all tents.
Mm-hmm.
that was it. We had some shows that would come over, but and I guess somewhere they had movies, but again, we never went because once we were finished flying, it was just. We were all exhausted. We didn't want to go anywhere.
Right. What was your typical day like?
6 in the morning, start out, go to breakfast. Then I'd go down and make sure that my clerk was doing his job, and the pilots who were on missions that day would take off and do their thing.
Would you have to attend a briefing?
There was a daily briefing every morning, and then there was one every evening.
Mm-hmm.
Sit rep briefing where you found out what was going on where, and So, but the missions, a lot of them were resupply missions for the squadrons. Like, we'd have to carry out the ammo. Because headquarters is the one that had the slick aircraft, you know, the ones that the troop carriers, or supply aircraft. And we'd take ammo out. We'd take mail out to them. We'd take clean, you know, laundry out, and just to keep them, you know, the morale going. Go ahead.
Well, how far out would you go? Was there a limit to your range, or would you just pretty much go wherever your mission called for you to go to?
Whatever our mission called is where we would go. Of course, we had to watch our fuel. You know, we did have. And, I mean, there were days that I would strap on, and we'd come back every 2 hours to refuel. And that would go on like 10 hours, and we never shut down. We would hot refuel. Get out, stretch our legs. One pilot stayed in all the time. One would get out, stretch out, relieve himself. The other would get out, you know. But
so what was your typical day, a 10-hour day? Or was
probably, close to 12.
Okay.
Close to 12 hours.
So you would basically just fly resupply missions, whatever was needed.
Yeah, resupply. We did some night psyops, psychological warfare.
Right.
With the speakers and all that.
Can you describe that to me?
Well, we'd be out with a Huey with the speakers on, and behind us would be the Jolly Green Giant. Puff. I'm sorry, Puff. The C-47 with Gatling guns on it. And if we were to, if we would receive a fire, then he would come in and take him out. We would... that would be a couple of hours every night, you know, but it wasn't every night. It was, you know, whenever, you know, really that was run by intelligence corps.
Right. What kind of things would you broadcast?
Well, it was all Vietnamese. I don't know what they were saying. But, okay. You know, give up, you know, you're fighting a losing battle, you know, your leaders are dirty dogs, you know, stuff like that. But,
how many days on and how many days off did you have?
We were 7 days.
Okay.
A flight surgeon would watch us for hours. Once we got to, up to like 90 hours in a month, then he would pull us in and ask us how we felt, you know. Normally he would just clear us for another 30 or something like that if we needed it.
Right.
Very rarely did he say, nope, you're off for a week now. They did have, you know, what they call crew rest, but that was like you had to have 8 hours off, and that was it. I mean, but you were still 7 days. I mean, there was there was no 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, but because we were we also supported other units.
Okay,
we supported the 1st Infantry Division when they had an operation. We supported 25th. Infantry Division, and so as far as being there at the base camp, we not a whole lot. We were a lot of times we were out on these operations, and those operations last 2 or 3 weeks.
What typical things would you carry? You said laundry, mail, ammunition. You did some troop ferrying.
They tried to get them a hot meal once a day,
okay.
And we would carry out the thermites with hot meals in them. And then resupply for parts for the armored vehicles.
Right.
And it was, you know, they'd just go into a jungle and they'd clear out a spot. Of course, they weren't aviation minded, so they didn't give us enough room really to come in. I mean, we would come in and just circle. These trees were like 150, 200 feet tall, and we would just circle coming down, and we'd land. But then when we'd go out, we'd have to go out the same way. We'd have to circle to get enough speed up to get some climbing power because it was so hot over there, and they would load us down so much. Oh, there's many times I came back with leaves in my skids.
Wow.
Coming out, just topped it and lowered the nose and took off. But,
are there any incidents that stand out in your mind in these supply missions?
One time I had a rotor blade main rotor blade. It was a spare part. I had to pick up at Fuloy and take it back to our base camp.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I couldn't very well sling it, and we were flying solo some of these trips.
Right. Was it normal to go out with two, at least?
Most of the time, on a mission, you always had two pilots on a combat mission.
Okay.
But I was dropped off up there with a tech inspector and a crew chief and a door gunner to pick this aircraft up that had been had some work done on it. Up there at Fuloy, the one that unit that I was with for a couple of weeks.
Sir.
Well, they had a rotor main rotor blade, and those were they're about 25 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
So we stuck it through the cabin, and it was sticking out either side,
okay,
like 10 feet.
Right.
And so picked it up, and it hovered good. You know, we had a good balance. I took off. I couldn't get over 40 knots because it acted as a wing, and it wanted to keep taking my nose down.
Mm-hmm.
It was lifting my rear end up.
Mm-hmm.
So I came all the way back at 40 knots. And it was daylight we took off, and we had quite a ways to go. And by the time we got, you know, it started to get darker and darker and darker. And all of a sudden, I see these red things coming up.
Right.
And tracers.
Right.
So thank God we were high enough.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't bother us. We did. We got it back. But mm-hmm. A couple of the missions I was on, it's quite memorable. I did a lot of medevac.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, some of your dust-off missions.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it doesn't bother me. The one unit, we had a policy in our unit that there wasn't a crew standing by for medevac.
Okay.
Whoever got to the aircraft first went,
mm-hmm.
because speed was of the essence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and, you know, there was a certain whistle that blew that we knew that it was medevac.
Okay.
And we'd get our instructions once we cranked up. You know, they'd tell us over the radio where to go. So the first one I did was they hit our unit. One of the squadrons was out just on a search and destroy mission, and they were on this road, and they had taken fire, and they were taking some casualties.
Mm-hmm.
They called us in, and there were tanks had pulled off of the road on facing either side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And we landed on the road in between the tanks, and they told us to come on in. You know, everything was, they put out plenty of fire, and we picked up about three. And
was this your very first one?
That was my very first one. Okay. Yeah, I was in country maybe 2 months when that happened.
Okay,
and we took off, and I was on the radios, and this young man, I think I might have told you that, he had a pressure wound.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we had to get up to 3,000 feet to stay clear of any small arms fire.
Mm-hmm.
And as we went up, the pressure was building up. And he started clawing at me, you know, he was in such pain.
Mm.
So I just turned around and I held him in my arms all the way back. Because the gunner and the crew chief, they were busy.
Right.
And so we got him back. I don't know if he lived or not. I'm sure he did, because he was conscious. I'd often wondered that throughout the years, you know.
Mm-hmm. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was kind of eye-opening, you know. There but for the grace of God go I is what I, you know, that's the way I used to look at things.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, I'm not an overly religious person. I do go, you know, but I believe that there is a higher power that has his hand on certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just I was shook up, but then again, the adrenaline again was another factor that kept you going.
Right.
And once you got back, you know, there was always something else going on. So that passed.
Did you talk to this soldier as you?
Oh yeah, I kept telling him, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. Just hold on to me. We're going to get you. We're going to get you help.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And
did he say anything back to you?
No, he was tears in his eyes, and you know, he was just he was holding on tight. Mm-hmm. He was just, and he was in, like I said, I'm sure he was in a lot of pain from the pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, we got him back, and then we came back, and, you know, every time we get back, of course, you got to wash out the aircraft, because there's blood all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the pilots don't do that. The crew does that, but we, and then it was just, at night, it was unwind, you know. You had to unwind.
Right.
You couldn't keep it in.
What would you guys do to unwind?
Well, we'd just sit around and listen to, well, we didn't have TV over there. Mm-hmm. We had a radio and, you know, and have a few beers and just totally just become loose, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you couldn't, if you would have kept it in day in and day out, you'd have been a basket case.
Did you talk about it with your
family? Oh, yeah, we talked about, you know, we got, I was telling the guys about, you know, how this guy was and everything. So,
mm-hmm.
And that was our outlet, you know, talking to each other. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we didn't run to the chaplain or the flight surgeon for everything. Because, hey, we were there to do a job.
Right.
And our job was to fly those aircraft. And if we let every little thing bother us, we wouldn't have been any good to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, then I had another one that, I got the air medal with V out of that one.
Okay. Tell me about that.
That one I told you about.
That one,
they awarded me the air medal with V for valor.
Okay.
Then I was out on Operation Junction City. I don't know if anybody's ever talked to you about that.
I know about it, yes, sir.
Yeah, that's, first day we were out, I think it was Junction City. Yeah, that was first division.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, the cab was supporting them. So it was the very first morning, and we were all out. I had our maintenance area set up. Because, like I said, I was still in maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And my boss was a major, and he and I would always tent together in a small tent. And, you know, they out there they used an artillery round. They just bang on it.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have whistles or anything. So ran to the aircraft. Here we go again. I didn't know. Again, we didn't know what it was. I
mm-hmm.
cranked up because we had an alert aircraft. We didn't have an alert crew.
Right.
And I cranked up, and we got the what was going on, and they told us, you know, it was a medevac and where it was, and we started in, and they had we were radio contact with the unit, and it was ground fog. I mean, we were like hovering at 20 mile an hour. We couldn't get any speed because
mm-hmm.
we were going right up in a rubber plantation. They would have, rubber plantations would have a whole bunch of trees, and then there would be a swath almost as wide as a football field.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for them to get into to get the rubber out of the trees and take
mm-hmm.
them back out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were going up through this swath, and there's trees on either side. And we were in radio contact with the unit that had been hit, and I said, all right, can you hear us? And finally he says, yeah, I can hear you now.
Mm-hmm.
I said, all right, go ahead and pop smoke. And two columns of smoke came up, one straight ahead of us and one 90 degrees to our left.
Hmm.
And I said, I see yellow to my left. He says, no, no, no.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what about purple? And he said, come on in. And the VC had popped the yellow.
Wow, they were listening to you.
Yeah, they were listening. That's why we always identified the color.
Right.
Because a couple of times we'd have people say, oh, I'm going to pop red smoke, and there's two red smoke comes up, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And no, no, we don't do it that way.
Right.
So I went in and picked up, it was only one wounded, but he was pretty bad from what I understand. I was concentrating on flying then because of the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to make an instrument takeoff out of there. And I came up through 200 feet of cloud, just nothing but fog,
mm-hmm.
until I finally broke out. And we took him back to Long Bend, to the medevac,
mm-hmm.
a hospital, the evac hospital. And don't know anything more about it. You know, like I said, we went out there to do the job, and then we had something else we had to do. So.
Right.
So then we came on back, and then that's when I got my Distinguished Flying Cross for that.
For that one?
Yeah.
Okay. Was the dust off missions the ones that meant the most to you, or the ones that had the biggest impact upon you?
Well, I think I felt like I was doing something. I felt like I was, you know, contributing. I mean, these supply missions, yeah, I was doing all right. Mm-hmm. And I was taking mail. I was taking food and stuff. But these guys were running around, you know, and they were healthy.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that I was picking up were the ones that needed help, mm-hmm. you know. And that's, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I wasn't in love with flying a flying ambulance, but...
Right.
It was something I felt as though that I was doing that was worthwhile.
Right.
And so that's the two, the real medevacs that I had.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, we were Junction City. There was another one. I can't even remember the operation name. It was with the 25th Division.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of days were just pure boredom.
Of not flying at all?
Well, not flying, or just, you know, ho-hum type flying. And
mm-hmm.
But I was always fortunate. I was always somewhere else when my unit got hit.
Really?
You know, it's, again, that guy sitting on my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
I was out, I think I was up around Anquet. And there were people back at the unit. Most of the unit was back there.
This is back at Black Horse?
Yeah, back at Black Horse. And I didn't know anything about it. I came back the next morning, and they said, man, we got hit last night. In fact, one of the captains took an aircraft off that was still in maintenance,
mm-hmm.
and he just lifted it and got it out of there. None of the gauges worked or anything else, but he saved the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up to my tent, and I don't know, what happened to our war stand? Well, a mortar shell had hit our war stand, which was 6 feet in front of our tent.
Mm-hmm.
Went inside, and my wall locker had holes in it from shrapnel.
Wow.
And I had my dress uniform in there for R&R.
Mm-hmm.
And that shrapnel went right in between all my uniforms, didn't shred a thing.
Wow.
And it was laying on the floor, the shrapnel was. Of the wall locker,
uh-huh.
And but it just seemed like every time, you know, I was off doing something for the unit, and they get hit.
Right. Now, did you ever experience mortar fire?
Yeah, I experienced it, but mm-hmm. I mean, as far as anything coming close to us, no, I didn't.
How often were you mortared there at Black Horse?
Oh, it averaged twice a week.
Okay. What would you do when that would happen?
Well, we were so far inside that we just keep going to party and turn the lights out, you know.
You wouldn't go to a bunker?
No. In fact, our bunkers weren't even built.
Huh.
You know, there was a hole there, but they hadn't done anything else to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we hit the ground running when we were over there. What we built, when we started improving the unit, the base camp, is when we had the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, will you hush? And, you know, and that was a few of, you know, in the evenings we'd go out and fill some sandbags or something to start working on it.
Mm-hmm.
But to show you how far. Now, I went over there in August of 65,
mm-hmm.
and I was promoted.
August of 66, you mean?
66.
Right.
I was promoted in May of 67 to W-2.
Okay.
A lot of us were. You know, like I said, there were a lot of my classmates were there.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a party. We threw all of us threw a regimental promotion party.
Mm-hmm.
And coming back, you know, we all got back to the to our tents.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear this guy moaning and groaning, and one of my buddies was so bombed out, he fell into the bunker.
And he had injured himself.
But there were no covers. See, I mean, that was in May. I mean, we had been there since, you know, been there 9 months.
Right.
And we still hadn't gotten covers over top of the bunkers.
Wow. So you guys weren't that concerned with the mortar fire?
No.
Obviously.
No.
Okay.
Because we were so far in, like I said. That,
right.
And their range, like I said, the one that hit my washstand, that was a lucky shot.
Mm-hmm.
But,
okay. Tell me about taking fire out in the field and combat. You mentioned the tracers at one time. How often would you take fire going in? obviously that depended on where you're going.
Depending on where I was going, and also depending on what I was concentrating on, because that's what my gunner and crew chief,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's what they were. They were there looking out there. My job was to fly that aircraft, get it in, and get it out.
Right.
And, you know, I would say I probably took fire about a dozen times. That's about all.
Okay. Were you ever wounded?
No. Okay. No.
How were you flying the UH-1?
Yeah.
Okay. How was that as an aircraft? Describe that to me.
It was a beautiful aircraft. It wasn't built for that type of weather over there, though, because the aircraft would hold 225 gallons of fuel, and we could only put like 175 on it because of weight restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
We would go out, if we took American soldiers out for an insertion,
mm-hmm.
we could only carry six
okay.
at the tops. And then we were bleeding off power to get off the ground because of the density altitude, and that's with the heat and the humidity,
mm-hmm.
was so high, it was like taking off from 10,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times I told the crew, my co-pilot, turn off the low warning light because, I mean, we operated at 6,600 RPM. I was usually down to 6,000 getting off the ground.
Hmm.
But you did it. You had to.
Right.
You know, it was the mission. And, yeah, we could carry six GIs and eight Vietnamese because they were smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as flying, the aircraft was, it's a Cadillac. It's still a Cadillac in my eyes.
Okay.
You know, because I love that aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Very dependable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could take a beating and, you know, like Timex, take a licking and keep on ticking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why don't we take a break just for a moment?
Okay.
This is Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. John Balwick. Today is May 21st, 2003. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room, and Mr. Balwick is in Belcamp, Maryland. Sir, we finished the other day. We talked about some of your missions and your more memorable missions, your dust-off missions, etc. And I wanted to ask you if there are any other missions or incidents that stand out in your mind about your tour there in Vietnam. What do you think of besides the ones we've talked about?
Well, the one was a mission that a classmate of mine was involved in. He was, used to call him Junior Evans, and
mm-hmm.
he was the youngest pilot in the Army at the time. He was only 18 years old. He was in the Air Cav Troop, and he was a gunship pilot.
Mm-hmm.
He was out on a mission with his aircraft commander, who was a captain, and I can't remember his name. But they had finished the mission, were en route back to base camp, and he started receiving fire from just one individual on the ground. The aircraft commander said, "Let's turn around and get him." And he turned to him and said, "Look, all we've got is one door gun left. Everything else, we've used all our ammunition." He said, "Oh, we can take him out with a door gun." So he said, "Okay, you're the boss." And as he turned and rolled in for the run, a round came through the windshield and got him in the head.
Mm.
And he died about 11 hours later.
Mm.
When I found out what had happened, they had to hold me back because I was going to go and take care of this captain who should never have turned to return fire from just one little Charlie running around.
Yes, sir.
And that happened about 4 months before I rotated back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I never talked to the man ever after that. I mean, I would have just torn him apart, literally. That's how upset I was. There was no reason at all.
And you've had no contact with him since?
None.
Why would he give such an order? Did he have a reckless reputation?
No, he was career-minded.
Okay.
And he wanted to be, he wanted to go up the ladder, and from what I understand, he never got past captain.
Do you think he wanted a medal, or he wanted to be
He
recognized?
Wanted a medal. He wanted the recognition, and that would help toward promotions.
Did you see a lot of that over there in Vietnam?
Career-minded people?
Yes, sir. People trying to obtain medals, trying to obtain that recognition while they had the chance in the war zone to further their career after the war.
Well, there were one or two that I did see. There was a very young major. In fact, he was a captain when he went over, and he made major over there. He was, how do I put it? His nose was where it shouldn't have been.
Okay.
And from what I understand, he did climb. He climbed quite rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he ended up with a star. I'm not sure.
Okay.
But he was totally, totally looking out for his career track.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, you know, I just... A lot of times I just didn't fit into that. I, you know, I was there to do a job and did a job. You know, I wasn't, you know, when I mentioned earlier about that distinguished line cross, I didn't know I was going to get it.
Right.
You know, they just came in and said, we're putting you in for it. And I didn't go out there to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, you know, I had no desire, you know. You know, it looks nice pinned on my chest, but that's about all it does.
Right,
right. But, so that was the big incident, and then also was the one that, you know, that had that major I did too.
Yes, sir. Did you think the leadership in Vietnam was adequate? Not at the larger level, at the top level, but just at your unit level, at the 11th Cav regiment level. What were your opinions of the leadership there?
In general, it was quite good. Of course, none of them, you know, this was their first taste of combat also. But in general, we had good leaders. We didn't have any problems with the exception of the one that, you know, the couple that I've talked to you about. The rest of them, you know, they did a good job. And
mm-hmm.
I felt comfortable with them. Let me take that back a little bit. There was this one major who had just transitioned into helicopters, and he was a fixed-wing pilot for years. Well, the only thing is he tried to fly the helicopter like a fixed-wing, and it just didn't work. In fact, I, as a W-1, I had to take it away from him one time. But
really?
Yeah. It was just that he was getting the aircraft into a situation where it wasn't the safest way to fly it. But
how did you go about taking the aircraft?
I just said, I've got it, sir.
You were actually flying with him.
Yeah. Okay. I was his pilot. He was the aircraft commander, and I just took it away from him because he would like dive it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can dive a fixed wing, but you can't dive a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
You do to a certain extent, but not the way he was. I mean, he had our nose headed right to the ground. I said, no, we don't do this.
Okay. Could you make any comments about the overall leadership in Vietnam, military leadership?
I think the military leadership, the upper level, was too political. We, you know, no one was allowed to do anything without permission as far as firing on anything. We did have what they call free fire zones, but mm-hmm. that was, they were few and far between. The leadership was too, well, for lack of a better word, too milquetoast.
Okay.
Because the politicians were running that war. I mean, it was being run from Washington.
Is that what you thought at the time, or is that looking back?
Well, I didn't really think of it at the time, but then after I got home and listening to some of the other pilots when I was assigned to flight school, you know, they pretty much saw it, and you know, we just couldn't. The military just couldn't run the war. I mean, it was not done the way that a military action should be. I mean, granted, it was a different type of war; it was a guerrilla type war, but we could have changed that ourselves, and we didn't.
what kind of different tactics do you think that you could have done differently as a helicopter pilot, or your unit could have done differently?
Well, I remember back in 1964 when Barry Goldwater was running for president,
mm-hmm.
and everybody laughed at him when he said, the only way to control Vietnam is to start at the South China Sea with our backs against the sea and just put a line out from border to border and march forward, march north.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody in front of us were the enemy. Anybody behind us were our friends. And everybody laughed at him. But that is a classic war.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's, oh, it can't be done there, it can't be done there. But, you know, in retrospect, it would have been over in 2 years.
What about the Viet Cong, who could blend into the southern population?
Well, they looked like they were teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
They would, you know, be our friends during the day, and then at night, you know, they were the ones who were shooting at us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, yeah, they blended very well.
Mm-hmm.
They never wore what you call a uniform. They wore the black pajamas, or and so many other ones wore them too. I mean, it was, you just couldn't say, oh, there's one, unless he was carrying a rifle, you wouldn't know it.
Right.
And it was just a situation that just, you know, you just couldn't know who was who.
Mm-hmm. Could you make some general comments on the enemy? You just talked about the Viet Cong. What about the North Vietnamese Army?
I never had any real contact with any of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the early days, it was strictly a Viet Cong. Of course, the North Vietnamese were supplying them, but as far as being any combat units running into any of them,
mm-hmm.
Our unit never did.
When you were flying, what kind of rules of engagement did you have?
We could fire if we were fired upon.
Mm-hmm.
If we could catch them in the open.
Okay.
Now, I never ran into this, again, you know, being the type of mission pilot I was, but some friends of mine said, you know, they were receiving fire one day, and they turned to go after them, and these guys ran into a warehouse, and right then they were not in the open. So they had to call back and request permission to fire onto that warehouse. Well, their unit had to call Saigon and speak to the MACV advisor, who in turn, right, the desk right across from him was the Vietnamese counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have to ask him, and it was turned down. And it was later found out that the Vietnamese counterpart's cousin owned that warehouse. So it was we weren't allowed to fire. And that was quite frustrating, you know, when you had things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as just being able to go out there and just, you know, if you see something, fire. No, you couldn't.
Okay.
You couldn't.
Okay. When you were actually flying, what kind of weapons did you carry? Did you have a sidearm with you?
I had a 45 caliber automatic,
mm-hmm.
that I never fired.
Okay.
I used it more for protection, as far as pilots were. We were sort of vulnerable because none of our aircraft, none of them were bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
We would put a flak jacket in the chin bubble, and we would sit, even though we had armored seats, we
mm-hmm.
would still sit on a flak jacket.
Mm-hmm.
And my 45 went between my legs, and that's where it was used mainly.
As protection?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And you had a door gunner, or did you have
Yeah, they had the M60s on them.
Okay. How effective were they as weapons when you were flying?
They were quite effective. That they could put out quite a burst of fire, and it kept, once if we received fire from somebody on the ground and we started opening up with them, no, they would back off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one thing.
What weapons did you most fear from the ground?
50 calibers.
Why?
Well, they could reach up above 3,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big thing we had to watch out for, was that if we were above 3,000, we were out of the range of small arms fire.
Okay.
But 50s could reach us, and that was the one thing that we all feared that.
Did you have everything that you wanted as far as weaponry, or was there something that you wanted but did not have or could not obtain?
I think we were pretty well equipped as far as weapons go. We didn't. The only thing is, I felt like a .45 was inadequate, as because you know, over 30 feet, you forget it. You know,
right?
They've got to be right on top of you.
Mm-hmm.
And the favorite saying was, is that you fire all but one and you save that one for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the pilots did carry other sidearms, carbines, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just never, maybe I just couldn't find one, but, you know, they weren't issue,
mm-hmm.
put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
They would get them one way or the other, by hook or crook.
Right. Let me ask you about flying in general. How much nighttime flying did you do?
Oh, let me see. I had close to 4,000 hours total, of which I'd say 25% of that was nighttime, about 1,000 hours.
Can you describe the differences between flying day and night? Obviously, you can see better during the day, but what is it like to fly at night? Especially in a war zone.
Over there, it was like, you know, it was dark as a pocket, you know, the very few lights,
mm-hmm.
especially in the, you know, flying over jungle, there was nothing.
Right.
It was, on cruise, it wasn't bad. Coming into an unlighted area could get really what we would call hairy.
Mm-hmm.
We came back to base camp one night and came in blackout conditions, and we landed to just to a little red beanbag light, and we came in, and it was a dry season, and as we came to a hover, we were totally, it would call a brownout. It was total dust. We couldn't see the land. We couldn't see the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew we were near aircraft because we were near the revetment area of the other helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
So we just pulled straight up and got out, and when we found out where we were like 10 feet away from colliding with a parked aircraft.
Wow.
That was the thing. And, you know, that was when we were fairly new in country. So we learned really fast when you do come in at night like that, you go right to the ground. You don't come to a hover.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this guy did. He came to a 3-foot hover, and it just created a sandstorm.
Mm-hmm.
We had to use strictly, I mean, we had few instruments to fly by, but the instruments we did have, we had to fly strictly by instruments. We could see the horizon. We could visually, you know, fly. However, for going from point A to point B, you had to use the beacons because there was hardly any landmarks to
mm-hmm.
pick up, because it was so dark.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the States, you know, you could see, like, well, if I was 30 miles away from Lubbock, I could see the lights,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I could just head for it.
Right.
Over there, you just didn't have any. You had nothing to give you any idea of which way to go.
Mm-hmm. But you all adapted to that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you a question on behalf of those who've never been in war, never been in combat, never experienced anything close to that, and they might be listening to this interview at some point in the future, and wonder about your mental state as far as flying every day in a combat zone, did you think about the risk you were taking? I know you've commented that this was your job. Is that how you approached it every day? How much did you think about actually being shot down or being shot at or actually being killed?
I didn't really think that much of it. It would, you know, a lot of times it would cross my mind as we were making an approach into some place, man, is this going to be it?
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. The only one time I really had a problem is I was bringing an aircraft back from where they were out in the out on an operation, and this guy was having trouble with his one aircraft, and I was in maintenance. I told you that.
Yes, sir.
And I took it around the traffic pattern, and I said, "Oh, this thing's not running right." It was an H-23 with it was a six-cylinder reciprocating engine,
mm-hmm.
and it just didn't have the power. I told my boss. I said, "I think we ought to take it back." So he said, "All right, well, we'll follow you with the Huey." And I couldn't get over 500, 600 feet. There was just no power.
Mm.
Couldn't get over a 50, 60 mile an hour with it. And we had quite a ways to go. And we were flying along. And he said, "How are you doing?" I said, "Okay." Like I said, I was down there in what they call dead man's zone.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed over the highway. But it was still going through my mind, "Oh, man, what am I going to see around the bend and all this and that?" So I... He started running low on fuel. He said, "Look, we're going to have to head back to get fuel. Stay, you know, we'll keep the radios on." So I ended up landing. Oh, it took me about 2 hours to get it back. And when we tore it apart, we had what they call a blown jug, which means it was instead of six cylinder, I only had five cylinders.
Mm.
And the other one was totally blown, which you could replace just one, what they call a jug. It was a cylinder,
mm-hmm.
just like a car,
mm-hmm.
but you could take the whole thing out and just put another one back on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why I didn't have any power. And I was sweating that one.
Yeah.
It's one time I did. But that was about the only time I really had any, you know, if you want to call it fear, that
right.
was it.
Right. Did you talk about it, or did your unit, your guys in your tent, whomever, did you talk about it, your fears or anything like that, once you got back and had landed and it was, you know, after hours and you're resting? What kind of chatter was there about
this? Well, we would, really, after the fact, we would joke about it.
Really?
Yeah, you know, I had a pilot, did take a round into a transmission on a Huey, and he got it back. All the lights came on, but he got it back to the base camp. But once he shut it down, it froze up because he had lost all his oil.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it was running, it was okay. And, you know, he said, "Man, oh, man, I'm glad we didn't have an engine failure." You know, things like that. Were
right.
Just, and I think you just kidded around about it just to relieve the tension.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, "I almost bought it today," you know, things like that.
Right. Did you all have access to counselors if you wanted to, if you really had to talk
just
about
it? Just the flight surgeon.
Just the flight surgeon.
And the chaplain, if you wanted to. But, hey, our chaplain, he was a lieutenant colonel. He loved it. He was a Catholic priest, loved to go along and fly gunner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a really, really a neat guy.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, you could talk to him. You know, he would sit and talk to you about it.
Right.
But then again, you always had that fear, you know, if you say too much, you're going to be grounded.
Oh, yeah. That's okay. So you were you all warned, or was that kind of the word in the unit that you just didn't say too much?
Well, it was sort of an unspoken, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you could walk by the flight surgeon and he'd say, "How you feeling?" He'd say, "Oh, you know, I got a little stuffy head. You're grounded," you know.
Right.
So you didn't want to go any further than that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were they that strict?
Not so much over there, but stateside they were.
Okay.
No, they needed the pilots. They needed the bodies.
Right, right.
But as long as you got your rest and you were healthy, as I said earlier, you could, you know, after like 90 hours, you went in and talked to the flight surgeon. "Hey, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, you're doing fine." "Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We'll give you another 30 for the month, you know, till the end of the month."
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the relationship you had with the other men in your unit.
It was pretty good. Of course, I was, you know, I'm not a holier than thou type person or anything, but I didn't believe in going out and looking for the girls and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of them did. When I say a lot of them, I'd say, you know, maybe four or five, because our unit was so small. We only had like a dozen pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we, you know, we always kidded around with each other, and none of us had any problems with flying with each other. None of us did.
Hmm. Was that unusual or typical, do you think?
I think it was pretty typical, unless you had one that was just so, you know, out of it. When I say out of it, I don't mean mentally. I mean just that he shouldn't have been there to begin with. He shouldn't have been flying. He
mm-hmm.
shouldn't have gotten his wings.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, we almost pretty much, we relied on each other, and we trusted each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked about some of the things you guys would do to unwind. When you would come back, you would discuss your missions that day. How much drinking, how much card playing? What was going on as far as just your basic entertainment?
Well, pretty much, you know, we'd have a few cold ones, and majority of the time is writing letters to home.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
How often did you write?
I wrote every day.
And how often did you receive mail?
Just about every day.
Yeah. How important was that to you?
Very, very. It was our link to the real world.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever able to make any of the Mars phone calls?
Yes. Yes, I made about six of them.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How were they?
Well, it was astonishingly clear, mm-hmm. you know, except for getting used to saying over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they would patch us through. From there, we'd be patched into, really, it was a ham operator
mm-hmm.
in the States somewhere, and then they would, and that was the only charge we had was from there to wherever we were calling.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was pretty neat, because the only reason we had to stay over was so that we knew when they knew when to throw the switch.
Right. Right.
And but it was I a couple out of Saigon and then a couple around Tuan Lok.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to keep up with news from the United States while you were there?
Yeah, we did. We got pretty good. Can you, Richard?
This yes, sir.
Phone keeps buzzing. Can you just hold on? Let me
Absolutely.
Try to get this.
Absolutely. So you were able to keep up with news from home
oh,
relatively?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Was alcohol use any kind of a problem that you saw?
At my time I was over there, no.
Okay.
I understand that I think starting around 68 is when it started to get bad.
Mm-hmm.
Again, drugs. I never saw them. Like I said, I may have been totally naive about it, but I never saw them.
Mm-hmm.
And again, in I think in 68 is when that drug usage started to get pretty rampant.
Mm-hmm. Did your unit have any pets?
I had a monkey.
You did?
Yeah.
Really? What was his name?
Yeah. Mama John's. No, baby John's, because we had a crew chief that we used to call Mama John's.
Okay.
And it was a little rhesus monkey.
Where did you get him?
I think I inherited him.
Okay.
When we first got over there, somebody gave him to me. Her. And
mm-hmm.
She was, I had her for, I guess about 3 months. And she got loose in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, she never came back.
That was it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, would she stay in the tent with you all?
We pretty much tied her outside.
Okay.
Yeah, she liked to make a mess. She got loose one night and got into the officers' club and just tore it to pieces.
Mm.
And the colonel was looking for the owner of the monkey. And
did he find you?
Nope. Warrant officers have a way of disappearing.
Right. How about any experiences with wild animals or anything of that nature?
I didn't have any personally. I know of a couple of the guys said that they shot a couple of elephants, and but
from the helicopter?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
But I never saw any personally.
Okay. Were you able to attend any USO shows?
Yeah, I saw Martha Ray, I saw Hank Williams, I saw Nancy Sinatra. Those were the three that I got to see.
Where did you see them?
Right there at our base camp.
Okay.
Came in.
How was that for you? Was that helpful? Was it fun?
Yeah, it was pretty good. You know, it was really enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. How about R&Rs?
I took one in-country R&R to Vung Tau for a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Because Vung Tau was considered the, the French Riviera of the Orient.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took a week in Honolulu.
Okay. Were you able to see your wife?
Yeah, she flew over. And that's when I told her I was going to Texas, and that's when things started to fall apart.
Okay. Meaning you were going to Texas after you finished?
Right, yeah.
Your tour?
Yeah.
Okay. What was Vung Tau like? Did it live up to its reputation?
Yeah, it did. They had some great French restaurants, and it was right on the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you want to talk about Hawaii at all?
It doesn't bother me. I spent 5 days there and thought everything was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Saw a lot. Then after she got back to the States, the letters started to get less and less, and mm-hmm. she never mentioned anything about me coming home then.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing was she didn't want to go to Texas.
Okay. How difficult was it, jumping out of a war zone, going to Hawaii, without any kind of depressurization, if you will?
That really wasn't bad. And I waited. I waited like 9 months before I went on R&R.
Mm-hmm.
So that I wouldn't have that much time back.
Mm-hmm.
The worst time I had was when I returned. I'm in dress uniform and waiting at the helipad,
mm-hmm.
and my unit's aircraft landed, and they unloaded six KIAs.
Mm.
And before I could get on, they had to hose the aircraft out. But
wow.
That was worse than, I had no problem over in Honolulu.
Okay. How did you deal with that death that you would see, you could see almost daily?
There, but for the grace of God, go I. That was the only way I could think of it.
Mm-hmm.
I was, before I went into the service, I'd worked part-time for a funeral home, so
mm-hmm.
death, I was used to being around it, and it was overwhelming to see there at Tontsenut Air Base the... it was practically a full hangar that was nothing but mortuary.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked around the clock, the embalmers. And you could hear them, as you walk by.
Right.
And you would see the caskets all stacked up outside, mm-hmm. the silver metal caskets. And I just, with the exception of a friend of mine, that was the one that hit me hard. The other ones, I didn't know them. It wasn't personal. With him, it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, it was a matter of survival, and you just had to keep going.
Right. How much did your spiritual beliefs change, or how much were they altered by your experience?
Well, I was born and raised Catholic,
mm-hmm.
and I took it in with me, into Vietnam with me, and it stayed with me throughout my tour.
Mm-hmm.
Would never miss Mass on Sunday, and even then, unless I was on a mission.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't hurt my spirituality at all.
Okay. Did you ever experience or see or witness any racial issues while you were there?
One. We had a black major, and when you were asking me, I didn't want to just throw it out to you.
Right.
But he was, like I said, this is in 66. Mm-hmm. It was still a lot of, Martin Luther King and all that. This gentleman, he was a very, very good officer. However, he was... I always considered him black first and then a man.
Why is that?
Just the way he acted. He came across that he was, you don't mess with me because I'm black.
Okay.
And I never looked at anybody like that. I mean, back in the 50s when I was just out of high school and working, I worked with plenty of blacks, and I just thought the world of them.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy just had, he had a chip on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And he got into it with my boss one time, and they were sitting around one night in their tent, and I, through the grapevine, heard about it, and, you know, and he came right in, my boss came right in and said, look, you are one hell of a good officer, and you're a man, first, that happens to be black.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't see that. I'm black.
Hmm.
You know, and that, and it's a shame, but, you know, that's still today.
Mm-hmm.
Up here. You know, down there, you don't have the, you know, the incidents that we do up here.
Meaning up where?
In the Baltimore area.
Okay.
And it is a real shame.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, we owe them. Well, you know, I could say the same thing. From what I've been through, I'm owed.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I just keep on plugging away. And that's the way things, you know, that's the way I look at things.
Are you talking about the civilian population in general or the military population?
Civilian, not so much military. They've come around for, you know, as far as everybody being equal is good in the service, but civilian wise, no, it's terrible up here.
Okay.
And it's a shame. It shouldn't be that way.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Vietnam. Thinking back on it, was there a particularly humorous incident that comes to mind, if you think back?
Just the time when that friend of mine fell into the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
When he was, it was our promotion party, and he had trouble getting back to the base camp. In fact, he fell twice. I mean, he'd get back to the tent.
Mm-hmm.
At night, when the PX would shut down, they have guards posted around it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way back from the club, he fell into the ditch by the PX.
Mm-hmm.
And he's moaning and groaning. And these young troopers are, you know, who's there? What's going on? You know,
right.
And he said, I thought I was going to be shot on the spot. And then when he got back to our tent, he fell into the bunker.
Uh-huh.
Lay there all night.
Just let him sleep there.
Yeah.
You mentioned on your questionnaire an incident about flying out of Tanzanut and...
Oh, yeah, the little guy.
Yes, sir.
when helicopters came out of Tanzanut Air Base, since it was a very active air base, and there were a lot of fighters and cargo planes, and the commercials were coming in and out of there, we had to stay low. We had to stay below 50 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And until we got clear of the control zone. Well, I took off out of the helipad one morning, and I guess I was about 25 feet, and you move fast because you wanted to, I mean, you went full speed because you wanted to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
First off, you're low, and there's trees all around. You don't know who's out there. So, and you zigzag going out so that you wouldn't hold a, it wouldn't be a good target because, mm-hmm. you know, they wouldn't know which way you were going to be moving. And I came around, this copse of trees, and like I said, I'm about 25 feet, and I'm doing about 120. And, all of a sudden, right in front of me is this rice paddy.
Mm-hmm.
And this old papa-san is sitting there fishing. Well, I must have crossed over his head probably 10 feet above his head.
Hmm.
And, uh-oh, and the gunner said, sir, the guy is swimming. So as soon as I, because you couldn't hear us coming. We were
mm-hmm.
coming that fast.
Mm-hmm.
But once you got over him, it was like, woof, you know.
Right.
And he just dove. He dove right into the rice paddy. But, and that was kind of funny because we laughed about that all the way back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, But that, and it got that friend of mine, you know, I guess, you know, quite a few humorous things, but try to bring them all back now is,
right.
You know, it's kind of difficult to do. And of course you would laugh at the, you know, the least little thing, you know, because that kept your sense of humor going. And
oh, yeah, I wanted to ask you, how important was it to keep your sense of humor?
Very important. Let me try this one more time. Hold on.
Okay. Let me ask you about something that many helicopter pilots have said happened on a daily basis. Do you remember a particularly brave action that you witnessed while in country?
The brave action that I can remember is that when our unit was under attack, mm-hmm. and this, he was a captain, took his crew and put him in an aircraft that was still under maintenance, mm-hmm. and flew it out of there. I mean, he didn't know whether this aircraft was even going to fly.
Right.
And he went. He went with it. The gauges were all down. He had did strictly by instinct.
He wanted to save the aircraft.
Save the aircraft and get his crew out of there.
Okay. Now, you stayed for 1 year. Did
yep.
You said you kept that short-timer's calendar from the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
I assume that you kept that the entire time you were there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Every day. Every night we'd X another one out.
How did it feel when you started to really get short? Did you curb your activities, or did you continue?
Well, we continued up to about a week before we left, and that was our unit policy.
Okay.
the only thing we would do then would be strictly safe administrative missions.
Mm-hmm.
And another policy was that the rotating pilots that were going home were flown from, instead of having to take a bus, we flew them back to the replacement depot.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave them the ride of their lives, you know, at 500 feet all the way.
Right.
Now, except myself. Since I was in maintenance, I grounded an aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that needs a test flight. Well, I was a test pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So my replacement rode back with me to the replacement depot. I flew myself.
Right.
Most of the other pilots, you know, all the other pilots, they were in the back going back.
Mm-hmm.
But I flew myself, and I flew back at 5,000 feet until I got right over the replacement depot, and then I just spiraled in.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, nobody's going to get me on that last trip.
Right. How did that last trip feel for you?
Oh, it felt great. It felt great. I got back there, and less than 24 hours, I was out of country.
How did you process out?
Well, we went into the replacement depot, and, of course, we had our orders with us. And,
mm-hmm.
We went into this office and signed in, and... we got our sleeping quarters for the night. We were just there overnight, and they told us what time to be at what place, and that was it.
Okay.
The rest of the time, we were on our own. Didn't go anywhere. Uh-huh. I wasn't going to go anywhere.
Right. Where was the replacement depot?
That was in Long Bend.
Okay.
And then they would bus us from Long Bend into Benoit Air Base, and that's where we took off.
Did you fly civilian air out?
Yep. TWA.
What was the flight like?
Well, I'll never forget the takeoff. We were taxiing out, and I'm sure you've flown many a time where the aircraft gets out there and lines up on the runway,
mm-hmm.
and then they put the throttles to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not there. You were clear to go, and we were probably rolling 40 miles an hour before we even turned onto the active runway.
Wow.
And he just bored it. And he held it on the ground for as long as possible. Benoit was the longest runway in the world. It was like 13,000 feet. And he held it on the ground. And when he pulled that 707 off the ground, it was like a rocket. Because he wanted to get altitude as fast as possible to stay away from the small arms fire. And Phu Loi was probably about 8 miles away, which was where the 1st Division was out of Benoit. And I'd say by the time we got over Phu Loi, we were at about 9,000-10,000 feet.
Wow.
I mean, he was just going. And after that, it was uneventful.
Did he make an announcement that you had left Vietnamese airspace?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he came across, and then everybody cheered. And then we headed toward Guam.
How did you feel?
Big relief. Wanting to get home, wanted to get my life, you know, continue with my life. And little did I know that, you know, my wife at the time was going to tell me that it was over. But yeah, it was relief. Didn't sleep at all the way. And went through two sunsets. And took off on a Saturday morning and landed in San Francisco Saturday evening, 5:30.
Wow. What was it like at the airport? Did you have any problems?
Well, we went into Travis Air Force Base, and we got there, like I said, 5 o'clock, and we had to go through customs. They asked us if we were going to be permanent change of station or we were separating. And permanent change of station went in one line, and they customs didn't even look at anything. Separation, they looked through everything. This other guy I was with that I had met on a plane, we had to get to San Francisco. We had a 7:30 flight, and this was, like I said, 5 o'clock in Saturday evening. And we jumped a cab. We jumped in a cab, and we made it, but we were running to the gate to get on the airplane. And I brought back a Chinese communist rifle that had been cleared, and, you know, I did everything legal, and the only thing I had to do was hand that to the stewardess, and she put it up into the cockpit with the captain. And then it was an overnight flight back to Baltimore.
Okay. What was it like when you got back to Baltimore?
Well, we landed at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and my wife was there to meet me. Of course, I was jet-lagged, you know. And then we went to church that Sunday, 3 hours later. And I think I was out of it for 2 days, though, because of the jet lag.
What was it like transitioning back to civilian life so quickly? I know you stayed in the Army for a while longer, but just getting back into the United States and being back here.
Well, I was very jumpy. You know, if I heard a backfire or... when I was in Mineral Wells, they were blasting because they had a quarry. I'd go under the table.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I was very, very jumpy about any loud noises like that. And I was told that's normal.
How long did that last?
Oh, about a month.
Were there anything else, any other incidents that happened? Or anything that would trigger something for you?
No, that was pretty much it. I didn't have any, you know, I didn't have any temper flare-ups or anything like that. I pretty much blended right back in. The only thing I had a problem with was with my wife at the time. And in fact, I was even grounded at Fort Walters. The flight surgeon says, you can't fly. You're just too worked up. And he even talked to her, and it didn't do any good, so... I mean, I tried everything I could to keep it together, but it didn't work. So
you transferred. You got it transferred out to back to Fort Walters.
Fort Walters, Texas. Yeah.
Okay. How much longer did you stay active?
15 months.
Okay.
And then I stayed there for another year as a civilian instructor pilot.
Okay. What were your duties in those last 15 months?
I was a primary helicopter instructor pilot. I took the kids that had never even been in one and got them through their solo and their primary one test flights. Well, I mean, check rides. And that was it. I mean, we had it pretty easy. It was 5 hours a day is all we worked.
Okay. Did you discuss your Vietnam?
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you discuss your Vietnam experience with other people, or and how much did they ask about it?
When we first got back?
Yes, sir. And then into those 15 months and thereafter.
The students would ask us, you know, what it would be like, you know, and things like that.
Because they were going, right?
Yeah, they were going. That's what they were being trained for.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we were told that we could not even wash a student out.
Really?
Right. Because wow. They needed the body so much. They had to resign. They could resign.
Mm-hmm.
So, the unofficial word was you go up there and scare the pants off of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll quit. If you don't think that they're going to make it.
Mm-hmm. Did that work?
It worked with some it did. With others, they made it through, and they, some of them were even sent back for additional training after going to Vietnam.
Hmm.
They weren't good enough to fly over there.
Mm-hmm.
But they pretty much left us alone when we were instructor pilots. It was like, you know, a five-hour-a-day job. We didn't have any extra duties or anything.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How much did you keep up with the continuing war effort in Southeast Asia once you had returned back stateside?
Just what was on the news. We would watch the news and see what was going on. But and we'd say, hey, yeah, we were there, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, most of the pilots were married, and they had their own lives, and they just went back into being a married guy. And, of course, I wasn't. And after my wife left me, I got a couple roommates. And we used to sit around and talk. And there's one guy, Ed John. He was up north, and he was rooming with me.
Mm-hmm.
And we would sit and talk about our war stories. Yeah. And really, it was the funny things we were talking about. We didn't talk about the bad stuff.
Why not, do you think?
I don't know. Just didn't want to talk about it anymore.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't that it bothered us. It just, hey, you know, that's in the past. That was our past life, and now we're into this new life.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the anti-war movement that was going on around you?
I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it at all. I used to tease people and say, they said, what are you going to do when you go back? I said, we're going to go to Detroit and you fly gunships. I'm from the old school, my country, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The demonstrations, I think, did more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
They divided the country. They didn't help at all when it came to the prosecution of the war, because all this was getting back. You know, again, when I came home, I was in 67. I mean, sure, I was called a baby killer, and
you were actually called that.
Yeah, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, that's what I'd say.
Who told you that?
These young peaceniks.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't do any good to have those the guys over there hearing about all this that was going on back here.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of them, I'm sure, got the attitude, what am I doing this for?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I laid a lot of it at the feet of the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Because they didn't want, you know, they didn't want the military to run that operation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sorry I went. It's one thing I, to this day, I will say, I am not sorry. I don't regret a day of it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them come back. They came back, and this post-traumatic distress syndrome, which I never bought into.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it was a crutch. Richard, I have been through so much in my life that, you know, that is, when I hear of people doing that, I mean, you know, I told you about my wife that, you know, she left me after I came back.
Yes, sir.
I waited 5 years. I remarried. I ended up marrying somebody that slept with everybody in the county. I didn't know it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that was another one. You know, well, just then I married a girl, and 2 years after her marriage, she died. So, you know, when I go, when I look back, and I thought, wait a minute, you get up every day, you know, you face every day. I don't want to hear this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I get very, very upset when, oh, boy, what it did to, don't give me that. Mm-hmm. Be a man.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, this is old school talking. I mean, I know that they've, all these psychiatrists and psychologists are saying this nowadays, but see, I wasn't raised that way, and I didn't live that way, and I have been down on my flat on my back so many times that I can't count.
Mm-hmm.
But I pick myself up, dust myself off, and keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've got to the point, now that I've retired, you know,
mm-hmm.
I made it. And I had a very good friend of mine. He told me one time, he said, Ron, if I'd have been through half of what you've been through, I'd have shot myself. I said, I can't even think that way. And I'm not patting myself on the back when I say this, Richard. I'm just saying, you know, life is too precious.
Mm-hmm.
And to let something get to you and take away, you know, something that you can control. No, no. I don't buy that. Mm-hmm. Things you can't control, you can't. You
right.
have to accept.
Right.
So, but no, I think I transitioned very well back,
mm-hmm.
even considering what, you know, I went through with my wife.
No disabilities, physical disabilities?
No.
Okay.
Some people call me an airhead, but, you know, besides that. No, I haven't. I was very, like I said, I was very fortunate. All the years I flew, I never scratched one, never got hurt, and I feel blessed.
What did you think of the media coverage of the war? You said you watched television. And
yeah, I think it was totally, totally slanted.
Toward whom or what?
Against the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I say that, and it's really this war in Iraq has actually reinforced how I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the embedded reporters they had in Iraq, they, you know, that was live.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't change it. What they were doing in Vietnam is they would go out with us, then they would come back and write their story the way they wanted to,
mm-hmm.
not exactly what happened.
How often did you have reporters flying with you?
I didn't have them that often, mm-hmm. but I did see them.
Okay.
But, you know, this deal with Lieutenant Calley and that My Lai incident,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't think the whole truth has ever come out on that.
Really?
You didn't know who was who over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was either you or me, you know, and it's certainly not going to be me if I have anything to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I'm bloodthirsty or anything like that, but when you go into there was one incident. It didn't happen in Air Base Camp. It happened in another one, but we got the word, and this was one of the reasons why our commanding officer would not allow locals on the base, mm-hmm. was this little girl came and went, all for a month, 2 months, and she was cleaning up the tents for the GIs, and she was getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day she walked in there and reached under her dress and blew herself up and a bunch of GIs.
Hmm.
Because she was embedded there and she was told, you know, when you pull this, you're going to, you know, it'd be a real good, nice surprise for your GI friends.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't know what she was doing. So, and this girl was like 14 years old.
Wow.
So, you know, when you hear of, Lieutenant Calley and me lie about the children and all that. You didn't know.
Even the kids.
You did not know.
Mm-hmm. So you think the media basically had portrayed what the American forces were doing inaccurately?
Oh, yes. We were, you know, we were animals. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way that it was portrayed. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they'd report that, oh, they shot up so many water buffalo, you know, and mm-hmm. things like this. But they didn't say that the people, you know, who was hiding behind a water buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just, and that's why I very rarely, there's only one channel that I watch news on now, and that's Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you hear what happened with CNN, you know, they knew what was going on in Iraq years ago
mm-hmm.
about the torture and all that, but they kept quiet because they wanted to stay there. Now, you know, that's not true reporting. That's not reporting the news.
Mm-hmm.
And to do it the way it should have been done, I don't think there would have been the demonstrations that there were.
Okay. Did you think that the United States policy of Vietnamization would work? Did you think the South Vietnamese indigenous forces could actually defend their country without the United States?
No.
Why not?
No. First off, they were cowards.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a little strong. Maybe they weren't cowards, but they depended on us too much.
Mm-hmm.
That we were the ones to go out there and clean up the mess. But no, it would. I don't think it ever would have worked, given the leadership that the South Vietnamese had. I mean, political and military.
Okay.
First off, they didn't have the drive that the North had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Viet Cong and the North, I mean, they had an overwhelming passion about that. The South didn't.
Why do you think the South did not?
I think they were just tired. You know, they'd had the French in there for eons.
Mm-hmm.
They had always been under conflict for the past 200 years, you know, and this was nothing new, and they were just tired of it. You know, let it go whichever way it goes. And from what I understand now is that, you know, you and I can go ahead and take a vacation and go to Vietnam.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Talk about a funny incident. There was one funny that I went to a reunion one time, mm-hmm. and this gentleman from our old unit, he got up and spoke, and he also belongs to the VVA, Vietnam Veterans of America.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we went back, and we went back as a group, and we had a major, a Vietnamese major, was our tour guide.
Mm-hmm.
And we had told him we wanted to see where we had, you know, had our operations and things like that. So they were very, very open about it, and they were very hospitable, and this major was taking them around. And so one day he said, I wore my Black Horse shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And this major looked at him, and this major walked with a limp, and he looked at that insignia. And he's Black Horse. And the guy said, yeah, Black Horse. Black Horse, Black Horse. He started pointing to his leg. Black Horse is the one that shot his leg.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and they laughed about it, you know. Mm-hmm. And he said it was quite, he said, at first I didn't know how he was going to take it. And then mm-hmm. he started laughing, and then he said everything was all right.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel like, you know, the politicians let us down there.
What do you think the United States could have done differently?
Let the military run the war.
Okay.
Just like George Bush did with Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How did you feel in 1973 when the United States withdrew its forces?
Oh, I was disgusted. Can't believe that this is going on. And then in 75 when mm-hmm. they airlifted. I watched every bit of that on TV,
mm-hmm.
airlifting out of the embassy. And so sad, the people that they did leave behind.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just like, you know, what did we do it for? Was this all for just a waste of time and money and lives?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, then you just pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and keep on going.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think other Vietnam veterans have not been able to do that? Not a majority of them, but some. And I'm talking about really the mythology of the Vietnam vet, that this individual is a disturbed, kind of a troublemaker, whereas the majority of Vietnam vets went on to live, you know, very, very productive lives.
Well, that's what I was saying about that post-traumatic distress syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a crutch. I think it's gotten to the point where it's, well, it's not so much now because it's been so long, but there for the longest time it was, they had the impression, you owe me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do what I want, and you're still going to have to take care of me. And I just don't buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they would have gone down the same road had they not been to Vietnam.
Okay.
That's just my opinion. Like I said, I'm no pro at it.
And, mm-hmm.
But my boss at the post office, I told you I work part-time at the post office.
Yes, sir.
He's a Vietnam vet.
Mm-hmm.
And he was Special Forces.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what they were in.
Yes, sir.
And he's just so laid back. And he looks out for his, there's quite a few vets there at the post office. And he looks out for them all.
Mm-hmm.
Like today he gave me a t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
We have a bridge here in Baltimore. It used to be called the Hanover Street Bridge. It's now the Vietnam Memorial Bridge.
Hmm.
And he gave me this shirt. It's got Vietnam. It's got the bridge on it, you know, and all this and that. So, in fact, he wants your website because he wants to get a hold of you.
Okay. I'll be sure to give that to you.
And he also said he may be posting it in the bulletin.
Okay. Great. I'll make sure I get that to you when we finish the interview.
Okay. But, so, you know, I just can't buy it. Now, like I said, here's a guy that was Special Forces and everything else. Now he's a postmaster.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that, like I said, whether or not they'd have gone there, they would have probably ended up the same way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything that you would change about your individual experience in Vietnam?
I'd have gone over single.
Okay.
I wouldn't have wanted any ties back here. Well, mainly, not so much that. It's, you know, what happened to me when I got home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when she left. I would have waited to marry when I got back.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The way I went over, I think was the best way to go with a unit. A lot of times I say, don't ever do that because the logistics is a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
But at least you're with people you know,
mm-hmm.
that you've trained with. And you go over there as a replacement, you're totally alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but no, I think, no, I wouldn't have really changed anything that... except for the, you know, going over single.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while you were there?
As a pilot, you have to have total trust in your co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And your crew. I'll have to say crew, not just your pilot, co-pilot. Because we had to operate as a well-oiled machine together.
Mm-hmm.
And... just trust in your co-workers, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would have to be. Because alone you couldn't make it. Working together, you're going to pull through.
Mm-hmm. Looking back on it now, how much do you think the war has affected your life? And how do you think it has most significantly?
I think the marriage was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, how can I put this? I think I'm a better person for it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the military, war or not, I think the military did me a lot of good.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I'm a better man for it. I really do. When I went into the service, I was a nerd.
Mm-hmm.
I'm far from a nerd now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my wife can tell when she says, I can tell when you get upset because your military voice comes out. But I think it made me a better man. It made me more of a man.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a high school reunion back in February.
Mm-hmm.
And the people could not believe. I hadn't seen some of these since 1958.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, I was a nerd then. They couldn't believe that I put 25 years in the Army.
Hmm.
Not you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I just wasn't like that. And but it made... Now, one thing it did do for me, and I don't know if it's a good thing or not, but I cannot work inside.
What do you mean?
I could never sit behind a desk. I would go out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that is the military. Because I was always outside.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very cramped if I'm stuck behind a desk.
Does that have a lot to do with your helicopter flying?
I think it had a lot to do with it because... I get very bored behind a desk.
Mm-hmm.
I come up here to, right now I'm in my office, and I come up here to just to write bills out.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I want to get out of here. You know, I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting and talking on the phone is a different story, but sitting behind a desk and have to do paperwork, nah, not me.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be a bookworm. I still read a lot, but I mean, as far as I used to be able to sit up and do work at a desk for
mm-hmm.
hours. No, not anymore.
Hmm. Have you read any books on Vietnam?
Yeah, oh yeah. What was that one? Oh my God. It was about a helicopter pilot. And I gave it to somebody to read and never got it back.
Hmm.
The guy's in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. And really, really, really a good book. But,
so you do
I've read quite. I've read quite. Now a lot of it I've read is fiction. I'll be honest with you. And,
okay.
But,
you do read about the war.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Okay. Do you think the war has been covered adequately in the literature since the war ended?
I think they've done a pretty good job. In fact, I think things have turned around now,
mm-hmm.
Where. The veterans are getting more respect than they ever did. When I first got back, you didn't go into the 7-Eleven in uniform.
What would happen to you?
They just the snide remarks, you know, from the peaceniks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Baby killer, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they told us, Jay, if you got to stop, don't stop on the way home. Go home, change your clothes, then go back out.
You think that's changed today?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
How about for Vietnam veterans?
Yes. Yeah, it has. People, it's amazing, the young people that ask me about Vietnam now.
What do you tell them?
Pretty much, you know, what we've gone over and that, you know, hey, I was there to do a job. And my son, he's 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He is so proud of me. That I was in Vietnam and as a helicopter pilot.
Mm-hmm.
He tells everybody.
Mm-hmm.
My wife, I mean, she is just, again, she is so proud of me that I fought in a war and came back and, you know, went on with my life. And I mean, she considers me a hero.
Mm-hmm.
I did my job.
Mm-hmm.
This office, she decorated. She's got all of my She's got my discharge. She's got air medal certificates on the wall, and mm-hmm. my diplomas from flight school, and you know, and she had a that picture I gave you.
Mm-hmm.
She had that made for me for Christmas.
Yes, sir.
So she's just and I got a wall downstairs in the family room that's got the picture of the Vietnam Wall. I don't know if you've ever seen that picture. It's about 18 by 13 high.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. And that's hanging there, and she's got my Black Horse stuff in there. And I mean, just, she said, that's yours. And she's got a model helicopter down there for me, too. So, mm-hmm. you know, I just very much accept it now.
Okay. Let me ask you about the way that the American public kind of learns about Vietnam and how they view Vietnam today. A lot of it's done through Hollywood, through the movies. What do you think of the movies that have come out on the war?
I think there's only been one or two that I've seen that were anything near realistic. One was Hamburger Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Platoon was a joke.
How so?
Well, it just... To me, it just didn't, you know, the way it happened, they put a year in 2 hours, and it just wasn't, you know, the only thing you saw was Charlie Sheen going out there and in one big operation, and then he was going home, you know. That's not the way it went on.
Mm-hmm.
Apocalypse Now was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've seen it.
Yes, sir.
With that cavalry officer standing there with his sword. Okay, get off my back. You never did that.
Mm-hmm.
Hamburger Hill.
Why was Hamburger Hill good?
Well, it was pretty much a true, from what I understand, true story of actually what happened there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the movie was for. It was just that, and it wasn't for to show a guy doing this and that. And there was another one that I saw that who was that? Who's that one that he doesn't act anymore? J. Michael Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox. Right. Casualties of War.
You know, and Sean Penn was in it.
Yes, sir.
That made me sick because I. Again, I wasn't on the ground, and I, you know, I never heard of them raping girls and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Hamburger Hill, there was one other one, and I can't think of the name of it, that was fairly realistic. And my wife doesn't like to watch those kind of movies with me because I just shoot them down.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, that never happened. You know, couldn't. That was never that way.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you the one I really liked, and that was Good Morning Vietnam.
Okay.
Because that guy really was there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was put out because of the way he... And I remember that coming on the radio in the morning. Good Morning Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what he did as far as going out looking for this and that, you know, I don't know how true that is, but there was an Adrian Gronauer.
Right.
And Green Berets, I guess it was fairly accurate as the way the those forward operations post operated.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They would come in like that in droves.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd pull out during the day. There was one that it was two personalities. There was an American colonel or major and a North Vietnamese, and it was about a little kid. I can't remember the name of it.
Hmm. When did it come out?
Oh, my Lord.
Approximately.
I guess 5 years ago.
Really?
It was where the North Vietnamese said, you know, at the end, that he did respect this gentleman, you know, mm-hmm. the American. I can't remember the name of the movie. It was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
How about the latest one, We Were Soldiers, with Mel Gibson?
That was very good.
Okay.
That one I liked. That one was realistic.
Okay. In what way?
Well, just what they went through over there. That was the, I think it was called the 11th Air Assault. And then that was the forerunner of the first Cav.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very more to actually what went on over there. And, you know, with the, I know it was a lot of a dramatization with the women waiting for the cab driver to pull up with the
mm-hmm.
Western Union. But, I always thought that an officer would bring it, you know, somebody from the military.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, that was a good, very good movie. My wife and I went to see that, and we totally enjoyed it, and I really did. And,
mm-hmm.
But the I don't know. I think a lot of the Hollywood, you know, they of course they trump it up, you know, because of for selling purposes too.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was a. The We Were Soldiers was very good. That's one that I didn't think of. I think that might be the one that I'm talking about.
Okay. They did portray it from the North Vietnamese side as well, briefly.
Yes.
You know, throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me take just a break,
just
for a moment. Let me ask you about your perception of Vietnam today. What do you think about the country today?
I don't really see much of it. With the news being everywhere else in the world, it seems as though it has quieted down. I do have to say one thing in the Vietnamese favor, and that was when they went into Cambodia, the killing fields.
Mm-hmm.
They went in there, and they got rid of that guy.
Right.
Can you hold, Richard?
Yes,
I got a beep.
Go ahead. You were talking about Vietnam, Cambodia.
Oh, yeah, I do have to give, to their credit, they went in there and got rid of Pol Pot and cleaned that up. And it's been quiet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear a lot about human abuse or anything else over there now.
Mm-hmm.
Pictures I have seen, it doesn't look like it's changed much.
Would you ever want to go back?
I'd like to. I wouldn't mind going back once, you know, to see what it's like.
What would you do if you went back?
Well, depending on the freedom of movement you had, I wouldn't mind going to see if the old base camp was still around, or I'm sure it's not, but, I'd rather take, like, my wife over, say, hey, this is where, you know, this is where I was.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I left anything there, but, just to go, for education for her.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
Not really. Not really. We have so many Orientals up here, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
We have Koreans. We have Vietnamese. But as far as having any real... No, I wouldn't... I'd say no.
Okay. Tell me about your experiences at the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. Have you been?
Yes, I have. It's very moving. It's very somber, very quiet, solemn. I found that buddy of mine, Junior Evans, on there.
The 18-year-old pilot.
Yeah, he's on there. And it's very tastefully done. I think it's the... how would I put it? As far as memorials go, I think it's got everything in Washington beat.
Okay.
The way they built it so the politicians couldn't see it, I think was a great idea. But it's like walking on hallowed ground, where if you see the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial and all that, it's okay, they're there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, these were real people that in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And It meant quite a bit when I went over there.
How many times have you visited?
I've only been there once. I hosted a reunion of the Black Horse here in Baltimore, and I arranged for the bus trip over there.
Okay. How about the rest of your men in your unit? How did they react?
They were all just about the same. You know, there were tears in everybody's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it brought back a lot of memories, and it brought back a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm. How do you think the U.S. government has treated its Vietnam veterans over the years? Have they been taken care of?
They're starting to take care of them now. Of course, I have no disabilities, but I am eligible for the veterans hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
I did an Agent Orange screen back in the 80s, just in case, because
mm-hmm.
my boy was born with a heart murmur and my daughter was born with ear problems, and I just did that to protect them
mm-hmm.
more than anything.
What were the results?
He's fine. She's fine.
In your tests, there was no
nothing
detected?
No, there was nothing. They just said that I had been under a lot of stress.
Okay.
But I am in their files, and that was the big thing I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
As far as, well, I can't just say to be a non-veteran. Military-wide, I think the government's let us down. They have taken so much away from us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I went in, we were promised if we spent 20 years, you know, free medical care and all this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, it's not happening. Of course, I get it for a lot cheaper. I mean, I pay $400 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I have all Johns Hopkins doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Johns Hopkins is a premier.
Yes, sir.
And so I can't complain, but, I mean, it's little things like that that sort of, it doesn't get under my crawl, but a lot of them it does, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have full benefits on post, and I'm close to two military posts here, so.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my boat is going to be tied up over at, Aberdeen Proving Grounds, and that's I had it at a civilian place for $2,000 a year, and I'm going there for $182, so that's a benefit.
That's not bad. Not bad at all.
But as far as I guess besides the medical, you know, the retirement's nice, and the benefits that we get are okay. I mean, we can go anywhere in the world for free.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, they do keep in touch. I have to say that. They,
mm-hmm.
You know, we get letters, we get newsletters, Army Echoes, and as to what's happening and things like that. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I guess overall it hasn't been bad.
You stayed in. You went to, after you got out in 68, you took a couple of years off, and then you went to the Army National Guard.
Right.
Why did you choose to go back in?
Well, to begin with, I loved to fly, and I missed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was extra money, you know, at the
mm-hmm.
time. You know, I could just see down the road that if I stayed, you know, that I'd have a retirement check. And,
mm-hmm.
So I enjoyed the camaraderie.
Mm-hmm.
I really missed the service. I'm sorry I ever got out.
Really?
Yes.
You stayed for 19 more years until 1989.
Well, I'm sorry I ever got out of active duty.
Okay.
I wish I would have stayed active.
And so, in the National Guard, what did you do on those weekends?
Believe it or not, I was in maintenance there, too.
Really?
Yeah, and I was a test pilot, and did a lot of training missions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Mr. Baldwin, is there anything else that you would like to discuss today that we have not discussed in our two sessions?
No, I think we've covered it all. I've relived quite a few years.
Okay. All right, well, we'll go ahead and officially end the interview with Mr. John Ron Balwick, thank you very much for your time, sir.
Okay.